Alright, time for another DraftPhysics.com. Debate physics also, but nobody's showing up. So I figure we'll do the Wikipedia page and, there'll be lots of places I can point out the obvious. I think it's kind of obvious. That what they're saying just isn't true. It isn't right. It isn't the... it just isn't. This shouldn't be what science shouldn't have all these subtle errors in it, let's call them. So anyway, so let us begin. So in physics, kinetic energy is an object of an object is its energy that it possesses due to its motion. So, the clear argument is what that means is weight, frankly, because everything that moves hits another thing with weight. It hits it with pressure. So you can understand that the only reason why your mass has any meaning, sitting on Earth, the only way you deflect the scale is because gravity has given you motion in the downward direction, and the Earth is in fact pushing you back, and you can feel it doing it constantly. It happens. Your cells are being pushed on constantly. There's a tug of war going on between your matter and the Earth's matter. They're both actively dealing with the fact that you are, in fact, in motion, pieces of you. It's just a fact. And so energy, kinetic energy, is a term. Okay, so now the first thing they should say is, don't be confused. We're using the same term to describe two different things. So we use the word kinetic as opposed to the word potential to describe in a system, where something is gaining and losing its energy, I mean, I can't even explain potential energy. It's so wrongly described, right? So, there's no such thing as potential energy. There's just energy in the universe. And you can be in a circumstance where you're obviously going to be moved by the energy that's in the universe. So if somebody shoots a laser beam at me, a very high-powered one, they could push me with it. Doesn't mean I have potential energy. It just means I'm in a circumstance where the energy in the universe is going to act on me, and I can consider it, I can model it before it happens. I can understand that's what's going to happen. But I don't have any of the energy until the beam hits me and starts moving me. Then I have something called real energy. But I won't have it until I start moving. So they're right about its motion. Mass, moving, that's energy. So it doesn't matter whether the mass is an electron, a proton, a piece of force, or a gigantic sun. It doesn't matter what the object is. It's an object moving. Something with mass moving. It's just momentum. It is defined as the work needed. So now they're using another trick word. Work. Let's see what they say work is. In physics, work is the energy transferred to and from an object via application of a force along displacement. So again, a long distance. And it isn't about the distance, it's about how long the force is acting on you. So how long the laser beam hits me is going to decide how much energy I absorb from the beam. It's not going to have anything to do with how long the distance of the beam traveled, and it doesn't matter how far I travel. That sometimes can be correlated to how much energy I absorbed, but not necessarily. And we certainly know in circumstances where you can have lots of displacement of the energy, that is, the energy can move in other directions, you can create a lot of heat. Now, might as well throw it in that, Joule's famous for doing something, kind of logical. He wanted to find out the total energy of things. And so the idea was to convert all the work into heat. So there was no work done. Nothing happened. Okay, you create a system, a machine, that doesn't do any real work. That is, it doesn't change anything in the outside world at all. It doesn't work on it. And it just creates heat. And then you just measure the heat, and now you can measure how much energy you were actually applying. And all the work is heat. And so it's kind of ironic that, they use Joule and use his experiments as a defense when it's clearly pointing out that heat is just another form of work. Heat's just another form of momentum. It's just you using up your momentum to move little atoms, to vibrate them. And that uses your energy. All right. A need to accelerate. It is defined as the work need to accelerate a body given mass from rest to its stated velocity. So all it is mass and velocity. That's the clear statement here, which is fine. And that's all that matters. So it's just masses moving equals energy. All right. Having gained its energy during acceleration, the body maintains this kinetic energy unless its speed changes. There's no such thing as your speed changing. You have to interact with another force. That's the Newton law, counterforce kind of thing. Okay. Until you interact with some other force, until you interact with another piece of matter that you either have to push along or that will take your energy, that is, you will push it, and by pushing it, you gave away what you had. But there is no speed change without something causing the speed change. So once you have a mass moving, it doesn't change unless a force or another mass moving acts on it, or another mass not moving. All right, the same amount of work is done by the body when decelerating from its current speed to a state of rest. So that's just another way of saying, well, it stays the same until something else acts on you to take your energy away. So you have the energy until something takes it away. The end. The simple, more accurate statement. All right. Formally, a kinetic energy. What? Formally, a kinetic energy is any term in a system, system's Lagrangian, which includes derivative with respect to time. So yes, it's of time related, and all that, and that's what matters, is how long you're connected to something and how much it's pushing while it's connected. So, you know, 100 pounds for a full second is the same as 200 pounds for a half a second. That's the simple functional logic, and they make a mess out of it. All right, in classical mechanics, the kinetic energy of a non-rotating object, so we know that that is kinetic energy also, the rotation, so you might as well talk about it. But yes, they're saying just to uncomplicate it, so they ought to just say too, a non-heated object, a non-this, all the other conditions you need to point out that it doesn't have energy in some other form that will pollute the energy you're looking at. All right, the kinetic energy of a non-rotating object of mass m traveling at speed v is 1/2 mv squared. So they state it, but it doesn't work. It isn't the truth. It isn't accurate. It isn't even close. Okay, it's way off. In any case, as you increase the velocity, you just make it worse and worse and worse and worse because of that squared term. The squared doesn't belong there, and obviously the half doesn't belong there. And it's just mv, momentum. That's all any object has. And again, you can clearly understand it from gravity. Gravity's moving you, okay? And you're pushing on a scale, and your mass has a weight. And you could duplicate the same weight going horizontally by creating enough of a velocity, okay, and pushing. So whatever velocity we're moving down into the earth, you can say that same velocity would create the same displacement in the scale, okay, going sideways. So it's something like whatever, a centimeter per second. I mean, it's not very, you don't need a very high speed to create your weight. I can't remember what I figured it out to be. It's not, it's like 10 miles an hour? I don't know. Yeah, sorry. I forgot. But yeah, you can duplicate it. So you know that's the default has been corrupted by the fact that we always think our mass is our weight. And the mass isn't our weight, but the mass is a number. I mean, it's a quantity, all right? But you have to still have the velocity. Without the velocity, the mass is zero. There's zero momentum without the velocity. And we have a default velocity in gravity. And then we add to it by free falling. All right. In classical mechanics, the kinetic energy of a non-rotating object of mass m traveling. Okay, we already did that. in relativistic mechanics, so this is totally useless. This is a good approximation only when v is much less than the speed of light, so it's just nonsense. The standard unit of kinetic energy is the joule. So again, joule is famous for doing one thing. Let's see what they say. Okay, the joule is derived unit of energy of the International System of Units. It is equal to the amount of work done when a force of 1 newton displaces a mass through a distance of 1 meter. So this is when we get into the whole difficulty of saying, well, it's 1/10 of a newton is 1/10 of a joule. Because you can just do that calculation. But then you're converting joules into a weight, and then they get really upset. But it's just a fact. Through a distance of 1 meter in the direction of the force applied, it also is the energy displaced as heat. Okay, so the important point is that the whole point of the joule, the whole thing that made Joule famous, was the fact that he developed an experiment that basically could measure total energy of a system. What's the total energy? Without, because you're capturing the losses and the gains, everything is turned into heat. And so you're just measuring the total energy by just converting it all into heat. Anyway, there's more to that story. All right, so we'll do this history bit, and then we'll do, this little image of de Chatelet, because there's an important point there. All right, so let's continue. So the adjective kinetic has its roots in the Greek word, whatever, kinesis, meaning motion. The dichotomy between kinetic energy and potential energy can be traced back to Aristotle's concepts of actual and potentiality. Well, the word actual should mean something. Like, it all should be actual. And what it should be understood is that you can find places in the world where energy is flowing in a direction. And you can essentially stick your finger in the flow, okay, and be affected by it. And that's all we're doing while we're in gravity, is where our body, when we're free-falling, is being pushed by the stream. When we hit another material object, the flow energy goes into the other object, kind of logically. And it gets pushed. So, there's no such thing as potential. There's just actual energy in the universe, and you can either fall into some of it, be affected by it, or not be affected. And that simple idea is ruined by all of this mush about potential and actual. Actual energy has to act on you. There's no such thing as a potential energy. You just have energy trapped, and you can untrap it. And when you untrap it, it's set loose like a tiger, and it will eat you, so to speak. The principle in classical mechanics that E is approximately mv squared. So it wasn't classical in Newton's time, okay? It wasn't classical even in Leibniz's lifetime. It wasn't accepted. It wasn't believed, all right? It wasn't until the 1700s that this, got any grounding. And it got grounding because there was no scrutiny. There was far too little, okay? So it was argued in Newton's time that this violates conservation of energy, that mv squared doesn't work, okay, because it creates too many circumstances where I can create a perpetual motion machine. So they're basically making the Lever argument that, well, levers make free energy if I believe this. So that argument was essentially made and just essentially forgotten. Not paid attention to. It was first developed by Gottfried Leibniz and John Bernoulli, okay, who described kinetic energy as the living force, vis viva. So I don't know why they added a second guy, because it seems to be all Leibniz, but whatever. Wilhelm Grevis Sand, I think, something like that, of the Netherlands provided experimental evidence of this relationship by dropping weights of different heights from different heights into a block of clay. So these are the famous experiments proving this relationship. And so there's, if you think about it, there's absolutely no reason to think clay is a very good way of testing energy, because you could understand that the clay would soften as it heats, and that anything that heats the clay will end up getting a freer ride through the clay than something that doesn't heat the clay. So clearly, fast objects will create more heat, okay, in their first interactions with the clay, blah, blah, you can write your own story. So if I mix cornstarch into the clay, eventually I can add enough cornstarch where the clay will act completely inversely. And it'll all be, it'll have a huge bias against velocity instead of a bias against the slower thing with the heavier mass. And I can get completely different proof. So it's a really bad scientific way of evaluating, because it was never established that clay treats fast things the same way as it treats slow things. Okay, so it's just a confirmation bias kind of experiment. It just basically tells you what you want to hear, and so you listen. But it's not the truth. Okay. Determine that the penetration depth was proportional to the square of their impact speed. Okay, so Emile de Chatelet recognized the implications of the experiment and published an explanation. There was no explanation, so that's nonsense. But the more important little piece, so we'll move over here, okay, is this little bit here. with a pair of compasses in her right hand, she was the first to publish the relation for kinetic energy, so EKM. So they're making, they're implying that somehow they had this idea of kinetic, the word, and they didn't have that word, so they were still using foot-pounds. Okay, it's approximately mv squared. This means that an object with twice the speed hits four times harder. Okay, and there really isn't any evidence of that. And there's no evidence that the 8-pound bowling ball going 16 miles an hour knocks down twice as many pins as the 16-pound ball going 8 miles an hour. Nor is there any evidence that a 2-ton wrecking ball knocks down twice as many buildings as the 4-ton wrecking ball. There's no evidence that it takes four times the amount of fuel to go 60 miles an hour to get to 60 miles an hour than it takes to go to 30 miles an hour. No evidence whatsoever. So nowhere else in the evidence pool do we have any evidence of this being true, or that this proportionality exists, or that you should believe it. All right. The term kinetic energy and work and their present scientific meanings date back to the mid-19th century. So now they're just fudging the truth. So instead of just overtly saying that, okay, for 100 years they thought it was mv squared. I mean, just mv squared, no half. And then the 1840s or so, they decided to change it and make it one half mv squared. So the foot-pound number was cut in half. That's the important part. Now, obviously, if you're just making a comparison between something you've already one half mv, that is momentum. So the fact is that the Deschartelet clay experiments and sand experiments are still valid as experiments, because you're starting off with the premise that both objects are doing this one half mv squared thing. So it's just a relative comparison. So in a sense, the one half doesn't matter because you did it to both objects. You change the foot pounds of the, you know, of all the comparisons have been changed. So obviously, it almost doesn't mean anything. It only means something in terms of the quantitative value that you gave the foot pound. That matters. So they made everything weigh half as much, essentially, right, by placing the one half in front of it. So the foot pound number changed. But obviously, if it was in joules already, it would have also changed that number, but it wouldn't change the relative comparisons. So it's important to say that, okay, so they're implying that, she actually did duplicate his experiment. So it wasn't like she just heard about them and that was the end of the story. She did duplicate them. And then she did some of her own with sand and blocks of wood dropped into water, as I understand. And the sand experiments are the real giveaway, though, because what she did is dropped objects in sand and then noticed how far the sand moved. So if bits of sand went a very far distance. Like, you know, you drop it into a pile of sand and then you knock pieces of sand a far distance. She counted the distance of the how far the sand went as the amount of energy. Obviously, the slow thing can't make sand bits go flying off at high velocities. It can only give the velocity it has. So if it's going 20 miles an hour, it can only give the pieces of sand 20 miles an hour of velocity. Where something going 40 miles an hour can give the bits of sand 40 miles an hour of velocity. So obviously, the higher velocity object will shoot more sand farther. But the heavier, slower object will move more sand in total. It will affect more grains of sand, and therefore it might move grains of sand a smaller distance. But if you add up all those distances, they will be the same as the distances the other pile of sand encountered. So it's, again, such a weakly interpreted experiment. No scrutiny, no analysis, no effort to really understand. And they still did this even in Joule's time, in the sense that they didn't get what Joule was doing, which was just converting work into heat. They did this with a cannon, you know, boring a cannon, and they, you know, had a duller and duller boring bit. And then they were just saying, look, it's all heat. Yeah, that's because it's all just friction. You're converting all the work into nothing productive. That is, you're not ripping pieces of steel off anymore. You're just rubbing the steel. Okay, so it's getting hot. But heat is work. You have to do work to make heat. Heat isn't free either. Shit. Okay, anyway. All right, so they say that the mid-19th century, instead of just saying, well, 1856. All right, early understandings of these ideas can be attributed to Gaspon Gustav Coelius, who in 1829 published a paper titled blah 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 blah, outlining the mechanics, the mathematics of kinetic energy. So this is an outline just doing a derivative based on a notion that work equals distance, force times distance, when work actually equals force times time. And then Lord Kelvin is given credit for coining the term kinetic energy. So what? Yeah. They also, so it's not in here, so in this page they don't say it, but Thomas Young was also attributed with being the first person to say it publicly anyway. All right, and that was, you know, they're saying here 1949, that was like in 1944 or something. So again, these histories don't match very well. Who had introduced the term potential energy in 1953, so Rinicky did, and the phrase actual energy to complement it. So again, you know, the actual word is important, they're all actual, but there's, you know, there's probably no, you know, there probably is better language, is all I'm saying, for the idea that potential energy is not something possesses. It's a circumstance it's in, okay? It's not, you know, it doesn't have any energy. It just has a potential to acquire energy. And that's a really important distinction that just gets lost in these really bad ways of describing it. But obviously, it'd be so much better if they just called kinetic energy actual energy and then save the word kinetic just for this idea of mv squared. Because clearly people, I can say there's no such thing as kinetic energy, and people say, of course there is. There's all kinds of things moving. You know, anything moving has kinetic energy. You know, but it's not that, you know, that's not what they're saying. Okay, they're saying 1/2 mv squared when they say kinetic energy. They're not making a distinction between potential and kinetic. All right, well, anyway. Actual energy to complement. Later cites William Thomson and Peter Tott as substituting the word kinetic for actual, which just, you know, huge mistake. Because now you have a word for two different things. You have a word for the kinetic energy formula, and you have a word for the distinction between, okay, you're now actually possess the energy versus you are right next to gravity. You know, or you're in gravity and the water, as the rain is actually hitting you and you're going to be pushed by it. Those two circumstances of you having after you've been pushed and before you've been pushed, there are important circumstances to make a distinction for, but this language implies all kinds of things that just break continuity in the brain. All right, so this overview is just terrible. So, okay, energy occurs in many forms. So it really doesn't. It's just in one form, and it's the motion of a mass. So, you know, that's well established. So all the other things you, all the phenomenon you watch, like some liquid moving, or radiant heat, or, you know, atmospheric vibrations due to heat. I mean, all these things, they're all the same thing. They're just matter moving. There's nothing else. Including chemical energy. So chemical energy, again, is just the energy stored in an atom because of how you've configured the atomic structure. You've created ions, you've created bonds that are unstable, and they can release extra energy because you can oxidize them or do something else to them, and they'll release extra energy. So they're just compounds that have the capacity to do a simple interaction. That interaction will release some extra energy, some little leftover bits. So the two atoms will combine and they'll throw off a couple of electrons. And it's just the energy of those extra electrons that you're really just saying you're going to collect the energy of their motion. Thermal energy, just another word for heat, okay? So yes, that's just the fact that you've created a circumstances where you're making atoms move. And if you make atoms move, that's energy. Electromagnetic radiation, okay, so that one's a little bit dicey. Obviously, there is no energy in a magnet, in my opinion, and I think it's a provable fact. And all the magnet's doing is reflecting the universe that's hitting it. So it's just giving back energy that's in the universe. So the magnet doesn't have any electromagnetic energy. It's just going to reflect the world that hits it, and it reflects it differently. That makes it a magnet, okay? It just changes the shape of the reflection, okay? And by doing that, other polarized objects can notice. They'll see the difference in the shape of the reflection. The light comes in purple, and it separates it into red and blue, would be the simple analogy. The red goes up, the blue goes down. You could understand that the object reflecting that energy didn't create the energy. All right, gravitational energy, and so that's just the stream argument. So right there, the picture is just showing you that's the better diagram, right, than the bent geodesic. That's all that's happening. There's just more going into the Earth than comes back out of the Earth, because everything that goes through the Earth pushes a bunch of matter and loses its energy pushing the matter. So for the period of time it's moving matter, it's not going the speed of light anymore, and therefore it's lost a little bit of its energy. It's lost a little bit that it's going to release back to the atmosphere in a timely manner, because the Earth has to keep being. You have to keep moving the little bits, okay, and to keep them moving, you've got to keep pushing. And so you're constantly in a deficit of the stuff coming out. So there's a little bit more going in than comes back out. Bingo, gravity. All right, electrical energy, just the same as you could talk about electromagnetic, so they're just being redundant, okay? But electricity is an actual force. You're pushing through a wire. You're pushing the electrons in. The electrons are getting hit by the atmosphere. The atmosphere reflects off the electrons, and as you move the electrons closer to each other, they push on each other. Not too complicated. Elastic energy, again, you can always turn that back into, it's always based on some atomic structure, which means that it's either that the atoms can be pushed together or they can't be pushed together. So it really just has to do with saying it's a compressible medium, where like water would be inelastic because it's not incompressible. Something like that. Nuclear energy, and so that one's kind of obvious in the sense that it's just the chemistry of atoms, all right, and the fact that you get the little bit left over when you break things or when you combine things, you can have a little bit of extra stuff fly off. and rest energy, which is absolute nonsense. So there is no rest energy. That's just baby talk. Let's see what it says, but it's just nonsense. The invariant mass, rest mass, intrinsic mass, proper mass. So all that means nothing. If your mass isn't moving, it has no energy. Now, obviously, the bonds inside of your atoms could have energy potential in the sense that there's little bits that can be released. But, you know, that's stretching the context, you know, breaking the continuity again. All right, you're really just talking about an object. So the object doesn't have any rest energy. So as long as I'm talking about a whole object, in the sense that we're not counting its, you know, potential to catch fire. We're talking about the energy it has in terms of moving in obvious ways. There can be categorized in two classes, potential energy and kinetic energy. So this is the real ugly terminology, because clearly kinetic means 1/2 mv², and, you know, potential could mean momentum. So it's like they're not in the same units. It's not a proper use of words. Kinetic energy is the movement energy of an object. So we've heard that. Okay, kinetic energy can be transferred between objects, and that's the key point. You have to give it, or something takes it, accept it from you. There's a certain amount of it, and that's all there is. You can't make it. You can't create it. You can't destroy it. So they don't even say that in here. You know, I mean, it's a kind of everybody understands that's the rule, okay? But that rule isn't said here anywhere. All right, kinetic energy can be transferred between objects and transformed into other kinds of energy. So there's no other kinds of energy. There's just this pressure, this motion. So there's force in the universe. It's bouncing off of everything. There's only so much of it, and matter can absorb it. Kinetic energy may be best understood by examples that demonstrate how it is transferred to and from other forms of energy. Or you could pull out a lever and end the whole conversation by just pointing out how there's no way kinetic energy could work, because levers would be free energy devices. They clearly are not transforming kinetic energy. They're just transferring momentum. So they're just converting one momentum into another version. So big V, little mass, you know, big velocity, little mass, into big mass, little velocity. And they have the same energy in the end. For example, a cyclist, so this is just, you know, this is sort of baby talk, because obviously they don't ever do these experiments, they never quantify them, so they're not very useful. Uses chemical energy provided by food. You know, does it not directly? I mean, it's all kind of indirect, you know, how the, you know, what the muscles are going to do versus what, how they were built in the first place. You know, to accelerate a bicycle to a chosen speed on a level surface, this speed can be maintained without further work. So obviously it can't because of friction and all that other stuff. So why say it? Except to overcome air resistance and friction. I think those, yeah, there might even be universal drag. You know, so even if you got rid of air resistance and friction, but anyway. So theoretically, bicycling in empty space, blah, 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 blah. The chemical energy can be converted into kinetic energy, the energy of motion, but the process is not completely efficient and produces heat within the cyclist. Yeah, so all of this is such a poor example when you have examples like wrecking balls and bowling balls and all these other things where there isn't a whole bunch of complex events taking place. It's a very simple event. You know, big ball hitting objects, making the objects move. The kinetic energy in a moving cyclist who is still doing it, and the bicycle can be converted to other forms. For example, the cyclist could encounter a hill just high enough to coast up so that the bicycle comes to a complete halt at the top. So now they're going to talk about somehow transferring your energy into potential energy, and that's not what you're really doing. You lost all your energy. Gravity took it away from you, okay, by increasing the friction, essentially. It's a kind of friction. You're flowing against it. You're flowing against a force pushing you down. And so you're doing the opposite of free falling, and you're consuming. Your energy is being transferred, okay, out of you. Okay, and you're giving it back to gravity, so to speak. That's probably a bad way to say it. But you don't have any energy. So when you stop at the top of the hill, you're dead. And now you're just going to do your regular pushing down on the top of the hill, weight. And it isn't until you go down the hill, okay, that you will now be pushed and gain energy. So they think your maximum potential energy is the top of the hill, but you really have no, you know. Yeah. The maximum potential can only be calculated by predicting a future. It's not in the present. It's only in the future. Okay, for example, the cycle's good. Okay, the kinetic energy has now largely been converted into gravitational potential energy. So there is no conversion. You just lost all your energy because you encountered a counterforce, and the counterforce beat it out of you. So now you're energyless. That can be released by freewheeling down the other side of the hill. So why would they, you know, this is, like I said, this is just such a bad scientific description of something. Okay, I mean, now you're going to just say, okay, yes, but it depends on the slope of the hill and how much friction, because all of that will absorb, and I'll take a lot longer. I'll be in the gravity. If I go down a sloped hill, a very gradual slope, I'll be in the gravity a much longer time, but most of that time I'll be losing the gravitational potential energy to the ground. I'll be hitting the ground a much longer time also. And the net result will, I'll just gain the falling distance. The velocity I would have gained if I just fell over the cliff. All right. Since the bicycle lost some of its energy to friction, it never maintains all the speed without additional pedaling. Yes, so there's losses to the environment. If you put energy in the sense of raising somebody up, and then, you'll never get more back. Now, the simple argument is their kinetic energy theory says a lever produces all the energy you want. you can create lots and lots of free energy. So they break that rule. The energy is not destroyed. Right, a counter substance had to absorb it. So that's what it always comes down to. Either the force has to hit you, okay, and push you, or you're going to push matter, and by pushing that matter, you're going to lose your energy. You're going to have to give your energy away to make something else move. It has only been converted into another form by friction with both air and the ground, and inside your bearings, and in, lots of friction. Alternatively, the cyclist could connect a dynamo to one of the wheels and generate some electrical energy on the descent. Yes, you could do this experiment and actually measure the real energy. Okay, and if they did it, they're going to find out that the half mass object going twice as fast is not going to have twice as many watts of energy. It's not going to produce twice as many watts. And they just don't do the experiment. The bicycle would be traveling slower at the bottom of the hill than without the generator, because some of the energy has been diverted to electrical energy. Well, you could argue that you could make that conversion complete, substantially complete, and absorb all as much of the energy as possible in the form of rotating the motor instead of friction. So you go a very short distance, absorb all the energy. Okay, another possibility would be for the cyclist to apply the brakes, which cause kinetic energy would be displaced through friction as heat. So there's, all the friction is essentially going to be in some form that you would call heat, because you're going to disrupt atoms, and the disruption of the atoms is essentially heat. Like any physical quantity that is a function of velocity, the kinetic energy of an object depends on the relationship between the object and the observer's frame of reference. So this is just more, always trying to convert something into, this stupid framed crap when, yes, that's obvious. I'm in the same universe as all the stuff in my local environment. And any difference that we do, anything that moves in this environment moves because some little specialized force had to act on it. But all the other forces are standard. We're all in them. There's no laser beams hitting us from space, and there's no something else. So we're all being affected by the same rotation of the Earth and the movement of the sun and the Earth, the movement of the whole solar system. We're all affected by those forces equally. Thus, the kinetic energy of an object is not invariant. It is invariant in the sense that the only way it varies is that you have to apply a force to it. You have to hit it with matter. You have to hit it with something. If you don't hit it with anything, it's invariant. If you don't change it, it doesn't change. So this is really a bad statement. Okay. Kinetic energy, any energy, is invariant. Alright, continuing. Alright, spacecraft use chemical energy to launch, gain considerable kinetic energy to reach orbital velocity. So this space problem, the problem of gravity, is what messes this whole thing up because of this simple function. The idea that gravity is a constant force, a constant rain, and that the truth is the faster you go through it, the less it affects you. So if you're going against, you know, sideways against rain, you could understand that the faster you go through the place where it's raining, the less rain that can possibly hit you. And the slower you go through the rain, the more rain that'll hit you. And that understanding of gravity, okay, makes it understandable why something going higher velocity goes more distance, but it doesn't get hit by the more distance. So, you know, this is again Galilean, but I mean, you know, if you launch something at twice the speed in the first portion, the first half of that voyage, it will travel three times the distance it will travel in the last portion of the voyage. And the other object going half the speed only does that first second. It only does that little piece. So you do 4 units of distance to 1 unit of distance. And it's supposed to be 50-50, but it's not because of this circumstance where it's about how long you're in the force, not how far you travel. So twice the distance, four times the distance, only takes twice the time. And that's the key component. That's telling you how much energy you collected. It's the time you're in the gravity dictates how much gravity is going to affect you, either against you or for you. All right. In an entirely circular orbit, this kinetic energy remains constant because there is almost no friction in near-Earth space. However, it becomes apparent at re-entry when some of the kinetic energy is converted into heat. So obviously, whether it's apparent or not, if you crash if you have your orbiting space shuttle and you crash it into a brick wall, you'll see the energy. So the fact that it has energy is already known. But that really has nothing to do. That velocity doesn't have much to do, frankly, with the fact that you have to still fight to get back to Earth because gravity is giving you energy as you're moving towards the Earth, okay? And once you're in the gravity free falling, you're gaining energy. So until you have something else to hit on, to land on, to take away your energy, you're going to absorb energy. So just dropping something from orbit to Earth causes a problem in terms of it's going to get hot, because it's going to be going through the atmosphere rather quickly. So the idea is you have to slow something down, and how do you do that with no atmosphere except to have some rocket to do it? So again, unless you have lots of fuel to use, just to reduce your speed, the only option you have is to use the atmosphere to create a counterforce, a terminal velocity force. If the orbit is elliptical or hyperbolic, then throughout the orbit, kinetic energy and potential energy are exchanged. So that's just saying if it's oscillating. Obviously, that's what a lever is doing. And if it's oscillating, it means the energy goes from one side to the other side, back to the other side. So it's just moving the energy back and forth. Okay, kinetic energy is the greatest and potential energy is the lowest at the closest approach to Earth. Other massive body, while potentially is greatest. So they're just telling you when you're close, you've got a lot of kinetic energy. When you're far, you've got a lot of potential energy. Okay. Disregarding loss or gain, however, the sum of kinetic and potential energy remains constant. So obviously this is just kind of mushy baby talk that, yes, you can only take how much the person has. So your potential to rob somebody is limited, okay, by how much money they have. Yeah, duh. Okay. Kinetic energy can be passed from one object to another. So it's just energy is passed from one object to another. In a game of billiards, the player imposes kinetic energy on the cue ball by striking it with the cue stick. If the cue ball collides with another ball, it slows down dramatically. No, it can do lots of different things. It can stop. It depends on. So we're back to angular momentum and all kinds of spin arguments. Ideally, it doesn't slow down dramatically. It stops. It Newton's cradles. And the ball it hits accelerates its speed as the kinetic energy is passed to it. So this is pretty bad when, you know, basically what you're saying is if you do cue ball, if you hit pool balls correctly, okay, without nonsense added, they will Newton's cradle. That is, the same weight ball will hit another same weight ball, and all of the energy will be transferred if you hit it, you know, on center. Collisions in billiards are effectively elastic collisions, so there's no point in using this word because they have to hyphenate it with concepts like superelastic or underelastic or some other kind of thing, because they have this other concept of storing energy versus transferring energy, in which kinetic energy is preserved. So it always has to be conserved. So preserved is what, I don't know why they throw in the word preserved in here. It's conserved, and they know that. So why they use this stupid preserved? No. In inelastic collisions, kinetic energy is dissipated in various forms of energy such as heat. So inelastic, there, by that definition, means anything mushy, okay, where the mush, is the deformation is permanent. So if you've got like a piece of foil or something, it would dent. Anything that's going to dent or move and not restore itself. So it's not a rubber ball and it can't be restored. So it's a sort of a bogus definition. Sound and binding energy, breaking bond structures. So it's okay to break bonds if the bond breaking will end up staying in the object and make other parts of the object more energetic, which likely happens in something like a super ball. But anyway, don't point and get too technical. Flywheels. So they bring up flywheels. I mean, you know, they should bring up levers. Flywheels have been developed as a method of energy storage. So it's just a big mass. You put all of the energy in as rotational energy, okay? And if you have a reasonable bearing, it can store energy. This illustrates that kinetic energy is also stored in rotational motion. Yes, it can be stored in any motion, okay? The fact that something's moving in a circle doesn't mean much, frankly. I mean, it's still motion in direction, so the direction's constantly changing. Doesn't change the fact that it's got a certain amount of velocity. And obviously the stuff on the inside of the wheel has much slower velocity. The mass on the inside is moving very slowly, so not much energy is being stored there, and there's a lot of mass on the outside moving quickly. That's where the energy is. Several mathematical descriptions of kinetic energy exist that describe it in the appropriate physical situation. So they say it's appropriate, I say it's totally inappropriate. For objects and processes in common human experience, the formula 1/2 mv² is given by Newtonian classical mechanics is suitable. So they just sit there and basically have just saying that somehow Newton had something to do with 1/2 mv² when Newton opposed it directly. Directly said it's free energy. Directly said it's a nonsense. There's no good reason to believe it. So it has nothing to do with Newton's physics. Newton's physics is momentum, okay? Newton said energy equals force equals the change in your momentum. That's what he basically said. So you change your momentum, you change the force did it. The force is, the change in your momentum is equal to the force that acted on you to change your momentum. So momentum is force. However, if speed of an object is comparable to the speed of light, relativistic effects become so this is just more not significant. And relativistic formula is used. If the object is on an atomic, subatomic scale, quantum mechanical effects or significant quantum mechanical model must be employed. So the physics isn't durable. So they're saying we have to break these rules when we go into relativity, and then we have to break them again when we go into the quantum magic world. All right. So again, they're going to call it classical mechanics when it's not classical. It's not Galileo, Newton, and Descartes. It's just Leibniz. Leibniz overtly said, your physics is too atheist. Okay, and he didn't win the argument in his lifetime. Everybody heard the lever argument and they said, gee, that's stupid. Why would I believe that levers are free energy devices? Clearly can't be. If they were, we'd all have one. Blah, 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 blah. So obviously it doesn't work. And it wasn't until later that everybody fell for it, because a woman showed up and, you know, dazzled them with some little magic experiments. La 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 la. You know, Mrs. Ken Wheeler. Anyway, might be enough. Oh, I mean, once you start getting into this crap, you know, their formulas, it's all over. It's just saying what units it's in. We already know that. The kinetic energy, 1/2 the product of the mass and the square formula. Okay, so they're just telling you the same crap we already know about the formula. And then they start talking about people throwing a ball, which is really stupid. you know, just stupid examples. All right. So there probably isn't anything more here that needs to be stated. Just the very fact that they are trying to imply that this has something to do with Newton's mechanics is just part of such a huge lie. I mean, it's just a lie to do that to Newton, to imply that he wasn't smart enough to see through that shit. Just very unfair. And I should have moved this back, I guess. Yeah, it's too big for the page anyway. So it didn't really matter. I read it well enough. So, the hell with it. Let's just get rid of it. Alright. So again, the lever points out that kinetic energy ain't possible. Because I can put energy in this side of the lever, okay, where the two mass is, and I can put 100 joules in this side, and I'll get 200 joules out this side. And that can't happen in the real universe. Can't. Not possible. It's also not possible to put the 200 in here and only get 100 here without this little fulcrum burning up or something, and that doesn't happen either. So it don't work. Okay, work is force times time, not force times distance. Okay, it's how long you apply a force is all that matters. How you are affected, you know. Whether you rotate, whether you do all kinds of different things you can do. It's just not about how far you travel. It's about, well, it is in some circumstances you can use that, but you can't use it in gravity, because how far you travel depends on how dense you are, how much mass you have. If you have half the mass, you're collecting half as much force from gravity. So obviously you can go twice as high just from the fact that you're half as massive. And if you're going twice as fast and you're half as massive, well, those are 2 times 2 equals 4. So that's why it goes 4 times higher. Anyway, it's also true if they're the same mass. So I guess I shouldn't use that example, because it's just about the velocity, which dictates how long you're going to be in the gravity. But anyway, so till the next time and such and so forth and whatnot. I mean, this, you know, I shouldn't have to beat this dead horse. You know, there should be some concession. Yes, I surrender, Gary. Stop beating the dead horse. Okay, we get it. Yeah. But no concessions. So I will have to continue and endeavor to persevere through, you know, what is a conspiracy of belligerent ignorance. I mean, people are just saying, I'm going to stay stupid. I'm going to reject the facts that you've made so clear, and I just don't want to believe it. Yeah, something like that. Anyway, enough. Tired. Till the next time, this has been the DraftPhysics.com video presentation. Debate physics also, but nobody can draw a lever. Nobody can explain anything. Nobody can do any physics modeling. And you need that. You can't debate a bunch of mush. They have to actually show up with an actual argument, a physical argument, an argument describing a physical event that can actually be tested. They won't do that. All right. Till the next time and such.